From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of true stories, personal documentaries, and radio movies. And on this episode, a brand new story from Unfictional contributor Eric Allen. And specifically, it's about a number of years he spent around the turn of the millennium as a headset jockey, making cold calls, selling stuff to randos on the phone, get-rich-quick schemes. It was grim, dehumanizing work, and it did a number on Eric Allen. It changed him. It scarred his soul. And then he kept going. From KCRW, it's Unfictional, and 1-800-KISS-MY-ASS.
I'm worried about absolving myself.
What do you mean?
You know, like, I don't know, like a...
Why is absolving yourself a bad thing?
Because how could you? There's too much damage to undo. Russ got away with $320 million off of people's credit cards. Like, you know, $1,000 at a time. People who shouldn't be doing that. There's just no excuse.
Hello and welcome. I'm Russ Dalby, founder of Winning in the Cashflow Business and America's Note Network. And I want to personally thank you for your interest and confidence in my company.
This is not a flattering story. I shouldn't have even been having fun during the interview. They subpoenaed me. They were not joking. They were going to shut the company down. And that's why I was sitting in my lawyer's conference room talking to two people from the Colorado Attorney General's office. You see, everyone I worked with already talked, but I didn't want to talk. Not because I knew anything, but why talk?
Winning in the cash flow business is a 100% proven system that will show you step by step how to make money with real estate without ever having to buy, sell, or invest in property. For over 15 years, Russ Dalby has been helping...
First of all, you got to understand how this works, because it's the same for any infomercial that's promising no money down real estate bullshit. Our hook was selling notes. Teaching people how to get rich selling paper. Teaching you how to connect buyers and sellers of promissory notes and showing you how to take a finder's fee when the deal goes through.
You just find cash flow notes, list them, and make money.
And if that doesn't make any sense, don't worry. It didn't make any sense to me, and I worked there for 5 years. At 4 a.m, everybody wants to be their own boss. You buy the book he's selling, and then you enjoy that feeling like a lottery ticket that just might hit.
See, okay, I'll be honest with you, man. I was kind of messed up whenever I ordered. I had been drinking, and which it was the main reason why I ordered in the first place. So you should advertise that. Get drunk. I do not remember ordering Tin Can Alley.
We sold the how-to book for about $130.
Use the simple guidebooks.
All you need to do is follow the program, and you'll make money.
It's not the book that got Russ rich. I mean, the company probably broke even selling that book on TV. It's the stuff we sold them after they bought the book. More training, more seminars, more crap. These impulse buyers wanted to be rich, and they had a working credit card, and they had a working phone.
My future is so bright because winning in the cash flow business, I've been able to achieve my dreams already, and I'm just getting started.
Most customers bought the book and only then figured out what the whole deal was. This was not easy. The book told you to work. Go to the courthouse, look up deeds, cold call note holders. And people did not want to fuck with that. They just wanted to be their own boss.
And for a limited time, Russ will include 1 full year of expert guidance from his team of success advisors to help you every step of the way. For over
15 years. So, the customer struggling with the book called us. We were customer support. But we didn't know how it all worked either. It was a little like calling computer tech support and getting someone who had never touched a computer.
I don't have a note to sell, and I don't have the money to buy it.
Well, you find the people that are holding notes, that want to sell them.
Okay, I find the people who are holding notes and want to sell them, and right. What do I do?
Then you act as the go-between person.
And the chances for failure were greater than 98%. Not because the books were written so poorly, even though they were, and not because it was too complicated, because it was just like any other real estate transaction. It was because the ad attracted a customer base with a built-in failure rate.
All right, so how do you become a millionaire?
A what?
Millionaire.
I don't know what it meant. What were you saying? I don't understand the words.
No, millionaire.
How do you become a millionaire?
Yeah.
Give me a break, buddy. America's No Network, this is Eric.
And that's how I explained it to the Attorney General's office. It didn't take long, though, for them to figure out that I knew much less than they thought I did.
Okay, it's a... Hello? Jason?
No, this is not Jason.
Okay, it's a...
Why would I do this, right? Arrogance, really. I scoffed at people who bought into Russ's pitch and thought that they could be their own boss. But my secret was that I thought I was a writer, which is a whole other kind of be-your-own-boss fantasy. I never thought writing would get me rich. I told myself what I did for a paycheck didn't matter as long as it didn't get in the way of my writing. But working for Russ did something worse.
From KCRW, it's Unfictional and a story from writer Eric Allen. The story continues in a few moments.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. On this episode, it's a story from writer Eric Allen, who had the heart of a poet, but he paid the rent telling irate customers they couldn't have their money back. It's a story called 1-800-KISS-MY-ASS.
Before I started with Russ, I spent years doing market research in call centers.
Hello? Hi, this is Eric.
Hi, this is Eric. Calling on behalf of PetSmart. You recently brought your pet in for an examination, and we were hoping to ask you a few questions about your visit. I did this in Tucson, New Orleans, Portland, D.C., with clients like Pizza Hut, PetSmart, Miller Beer. It didn't matter. And I did it until I couldn't do it anymore. One day, I just sat there. I couldn't dial out. I couldn't do it. I just left. Some people say, I have to work outdoors, or I just have to work with my hands. I say, I can't work on the phone, until I went to work for Russ.
For over 15 years, I've watched my program dramatically improve people's lives. Now, I want to prove that it can work for you too.
It started out of just starvation. I'd gotten laid off weeks before 9/11. And there was just nothing. And there was a place that advertised phone work. And that was like the one thing I told myself I'd never do is get back on the phone, but there was nothing.
But I told myself it was okay because the calls were inbound. I wouldn't have to call people at home and convince them to answer my dumb questions. The dumb questions would come to me.
Hi, this is Eric.
She kept saying, everyone gives 110% here. She was the hiring manager, tiny, dressed like a spokesmodel. And I didn't believe that she gave 110%, but I got the job. They put me on the phone so fast. My first few days were just reading the book along with the other customers. This went on for weeks.
Everybody says a police officer, are you?
What?
A police officer.
Okay.
You are?
No. Are you?
No, I said that.
I thought you said I'm a police officer.
Oh, yeah, that's what I said.
Bill, I thought you were saying you're one.
You said I'm one?
Yeah, I thought you said that you were saying you were a police officer.
Are you one?
I'm not one. I'm a customer service representative.
At first, it was funny. I mean, we had a tape deck on every phone. Whenever you got a call, you hit record, and they did that in case it was a sale. But they paid, and it's not an excuse, but they paid very well.
This job wasn't customer support. The job was to upsell. These people would buy a book off the TV, and then they'd quickly realize they didn't understand a word of it. Then they'd call us for help. We pretended to help, sure. We said, what you need is more training. Each call we got to customer support was just another chance to sell them something.
It's not like customer service where you're supposed to make sure people are being, you know, the customer's always right. This was protecting those fucking leads. Those leads cost a lot of money to generate. When you fucked with those calls, you were burning a lead. Like, you were taking Russ's money and you were fucking burning it. So it made me mean. But I was good at it.
Did you know that part of yourself existed? Yeah.
Not at all. No.
Don't waste your time on us, I'm telling you.
Then they won't send you the chorus?
Oh, I'd love to send you the chorus. You just don't have $135 to throw down on it. You can't afford our chorus, so I can't help you until you buy it.
Oh, so what would a person have to do?
What a person would have to do is hang up on me and then start their life and go look for an actual job and not fly-by-night fantasy things.
Look, baby, I didn't order the first.
Hey, baby, don't call me baby, Charles. You want me to help you?
I'm going to call you about anything I want to.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold and come back and see if you've calmed down.
A guy named Woody is the reason I got my first promotion. Woody was pale, soft, with long pencil straight hair, and he loved to talk about toys, television, and weed. And if I managed some upsell, you brought the cassette to Woody, and he'd audit a few of them to make sure that the sales were legit. But the tapes piled up unlistened to, and Woody saw it as bullshit work. One meeting, the managers asked if anybody wanted to take over Woody's backlog and start listening to tapes full time. Me? 18 months later, Woody worked for me. I was his boss now. And one day, Woody was pissing away time. I could see on his computer he was on Craigslist. It looked like he was posting something. He was supposed to be listening to calls. Remember when Craigslist had casual encounters? Anyone seeking anyone for anything? Prostitutes, adulterers, curious, perverted, lonely. The form looks the same for anything you post. A used car, an apartment, a job, a date. I figured he wasn't posting a job. So in a bit, I checked casual encounters for new posts. And Woody didn't put his name on it, but I knew it was him. Truly, I've blocked most of it out, but the tell was his reference to weed as a smoky treat, which I had heard him say in the office. I walked up to his cubicle, and I told him to stop fucking posting to Craigslist and start listening to phone calls. He was too embarrassed to argue with me and just mumbled some apology, and his eyes were pinned. It was a direct hit. This didn't help him get more work done, and I didn't care, really. Instead of dealing with his work habits, I wanted to fucking kneecap him. I mean, every interaction there became a chance to hit back. And that's what this place was doing to me.
So, before you make up your mind, take my course into your home and try it yourself. I'll back everything with my full 30-day money-back guarantee. Now, that means if you don't start making money right away, simply return the product, and I'll gladly refund your money.
I think I played a small part in getting the company investigated in the first place. The last few years I was there, we were making $10 million a month. So there was a massive amount of refund requests that needed to be handled. So many requests that there was a whole department devoted to them. Saves. And before me, saves had been managed by a girl so addicted to pain pills that she'd slur her speech, forget what she said.
Super gay.
The reps would call her about something and she'd start babbling. She was out of it.
Oh, man.
And when Russ asked me to take over this pain in the ass team, I said, sure. But I misjudged this one. What I didn't understand, if you managed saves, you had to be the final one they transferred the angriest or most problem customers to. Russ wanted to keep all his sales, but so many customers call back for a refund once they realized what was going on, or when their spouse or adult child figured out what was going on. They'd call and ask for that 30-day refund. And once Russ gave me saves, I told him, fine, let's start a new policy. No refunds, ever.
Wait, hold on. Don't hang up on me. What is your name?
Yeah, okay, the initial book. Take the money back, but the training, the coaching, no refund. Our complaints, of course, skyrocketed, and I was always sending in our side of the story, fighting every single claim. But Russ kept his money. He wanted that money. Now, around this time, I made sure my phone line was never recorded so that I never had to listen to those calls, so no one could. I didn't want any proof. When anyone insisted on talking to a manager and you bitched about it long enough, you eventually got transferred to me. I was the end of the line. If customers said they had a lawyer, I told them have the lawyer call me. But usually all they did was hire a lawyer to send some mean letter, and I knew if the lawyer wasn't contacting me directly, he wasn't getting paid. So fuck it. Who cares about your lawyer letter? And if a customer said they were a cop, who cares? We're not doing anything illegal. And besides, what's your badge number? Let me call you back. Anything to slow people down and call their bluff. But somebody kept insisting on talking to my manager. And they kept insisting on a phone number. They wanted to call my manager. So finally I said, all right, you want a number? Go get a pencil. And I waited. Ready? Call 1-800-KISS-MY-ASS. Bam! Hung up the phone. But that was so pedestrian, that was such a common occurrence, something like that, that I do not remember that happening. I was told that story. I should have quit then, but it was months later, when my bonus check cleared. That's when I put in my 2 weeks. What they really could only get Russ on was that his commercials didn't say the true success rate. Like, you know, there's a 98% chance you're not gonna do this. Like, what if you said that in the infomercial? Like, our sales would suck. And there's maybe a little bit, like, results may vary, blah, 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 blah. But there wasn't enough. And so it's because they advertised on TV and didn't give a true picture of the success rate that they got nailed.
How long were you there overall?
Like 5 years, almost to the week. I quit, and I didn't understand it at the time, but they immediately just cut me a check for 2 weeks and escorted me out the door. They were just like, all right, you're done. And 2 hours later, the Colorado State Attorney General came in and seized all their office records and started subpoenaing people. The junior lawyer told me that Russ fled the country with $320 million. It's like he wanted to shock me or get me mad and want revenge. Doesn't that bother you? The junior lawyer asked. It's his money. Money he made by conning other people. Doesn't that bother you? And once I felt sure that I wasn't a target, and once they could tell that I didn't have whatever information they were looking for, we started to argue about what was right and what was wrong. And I like to argue. So it got me stuck into this in the first place. I guess they expected me to be embarrassed, but I wasn't going to talk about my internal moral struggle with a couple of investigators who were trolling for evidence. so I argued with them for about an hour, and my lawyer didn't interject once. I mean, what about the casinos operating in Black Hawk? The billboards and commercials show a guy winning at slots. But do the actual odds appear on the billboard? Do the actual odds appear in the commercial? Results may vary. Doesn't quite cut it, does it? Or the bartender who pretends to be the alcoholic's friend. Or the stripper who pretends to find that lonely man attractive. It's immoral, but it's not against the law. My lawyer eventually did break up the meeting, and that was it. Next thing I knew, I was on the sidewalk, loosening my tie, drunk on the height of the skyscrapers. Remember when I said all that mattered from a gig was that it didn't get in the way of my daily writing practice?
America's Note Network, this is Eric.
Those years working for Russ, there was nothing. I mean, I sat down every day, I got in the seat, I did the hours, I kept a daily practice, but there is nothing from that period that I would ever want to read again. I wasted years of writing. I mean, each phone call, each time I argued for money.
Give me a break, buddy.
Each time I let somebody believe they could be their own boss, it was an accumulated toxin poisoning my well.
Then why are you still talking to me? I'm obviously being rude and abrasive.
I became somebody who tried to argue the moral relativity of winning in the cash flow business.
Nobody on TV at 4 in the morning is doing anything but selling you a product.
Tough shit. Right? No refund, Eric.
1-800-KISS-MY-ASS was written by Eric Allen and produced by Nick White. It was mixed by Ray Guarna. I'm Bob Carlson, the producer of Unfictional. The managing producer of the program is Carla Green. The editor is Nick White. Theme music by Alex Weston, with music help from Joe Augustine and Narrative Music. The Whistler is Jonathan May. On the next episode of Unfictional, a trip to find America with a Greyhound bus full of juggalos.
Is there a part of the bus ride where it gets really easy?
Nah, it's always difficult being on a fucking Greyhound.
From the beginning to the end?
Yeah. I told you should have flown.
I'm Bob Carlson. Please subscribe to this program wherever you listen to your podcasts and join me next time for Unfictional on KCRW.